We're studying Isaiah, the great 8th century B.C., before the time of Christ prophet. But where did we end up our lesson last week? Do you remember what we ended on? We ended up in Luke chapter 4, which is, 800 years later, and we're at Nazareth, and you know this Nazareth, Jesus' hometown, and Jesus is in his own synagogue, his home congregation, if you will. And they ask him to read, and they hand him the scroll, and he opens it up to Isaiah, and he reads, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, proclaim the liberty of the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." It's quite dramatic. He sits down then, and he says, "This day the prophecy is fulfilled," right in front of you, in front of your very eyes. And that's the prophet Isaiah. Remember, it's 800 years earlier that this prophecy is written. But the book of Isaiah is special. It's a long book. It's 66 chapters. So, just if you're trying to put this thing together, Isaiah. Think late 8th century. BCE or BC, before the time of Christ. And think about that. That makes it, we think of it in the 21st century now, right? That's a long time ago, right? Something like 29 centuries ago, something like that. 66 chapters. But it's particularly important even by the time you get to the New Testament because it is very, it's often said, messianic. It talks about the coming of Jesus as the Messiah. You miss something when you talk about these prophets of the Old Testament if you think that prophecy is all about prediction. In other words, it predicts little tidbits, something like Nostradamus, and then everybody's wowed hundreds of years later when it comes true. Well, prediction's an element in biblical prophecy, but it's a lesser element. That's something you have to kind of get past when you're interpreting. We're not looking at Nostradamus, Criswell predicts some nutcase clairvoyant who claims to read the future. The prophets thought they looked into the future, but that isn't the focus of what they did. In some ways, their real role is to give clarity, to give definition. And so when Jesus stands up and reads what he reads, it's to focus you and say, what does it mean that the Messiah has showed up? What's the role he plays? Who is this? And he goes back to Isaiah, the prophet, who could tell clearly what that was about. So it sharpens our picture of the Messiah. Now, one of the things I'm doing here is that I told you last week, the Old Testament is harder to read for a lot of people. It requires more background knowledge. Yes, you can sort out familiar and favorite passages like you can from anywhere in the Bible and just read that and not go any deeper. But if you really want to understand the works, the full books in their entirety, chances are you're going to need a little help in terms of understanding the background, the history, the situation. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. There's nothing unspiritual about that. There's nothing in the Bible that says, that would be unworthy, that a Christian picks up the Bible and through the power of the Holy Spirit just intuitively grasps everything that's there. Well, there's some truth in that, but there's also a lot of error in that. The Bible doesn't tell you there's no value in studying and understanding things as when it takes hard work. In other words, you have to watch out when people are appealing to the Holy Spirit, when they're appealing to the human spirit of laziness. Just give it to me easily and automatically. One of the things I'm basing this study on is a principle in Bible reading and interpretation that I think is very sound and solid, which is to understand whatever is written in the Bible as the original audience would have understood it. In other words, the book of Isaiah is 66 chapters. It was written within his lifetime. Most of it was written down, or at least the prophecies themselves were circulated. How would the original audience have received his prophecies? What would they have seen in them? What would have been the background that would have informed them as they looked at that? So reading the Bible as the original reader would have read it is one of the most sound Bible interpretations of Bible principle that you can work with. Okay. In order to do that, for this study, we have to learn a lot about Isaiah and his times. And that's not, be patient with that. I mean, you'll find that really, really rewarding to fill in that background. And of course, when you pick up the book of Isaiah, as I said, 66 chapters, we can't do every detailed verse here by any means, you'll find that a lot of them start to make sense and be memorable and stay with you a little bit better. All right. There are a few issues that I want you to remember when we're dealing with Isaiah in the 8th century B.C. I mean, one of them, a big one, is, of course, remember last week we did a whirlwind tour of history, and we said that there are really two kingdoms operating in the name of sometimes called Israel at large, but there's a northern kingdom, Israel. Remember we talked about in a southern kingdom, Judah. And you kind of have to keep this in mind, that the kingdoms divided. The larger and more powerful of these kingdoms is the northern kingdom of Israel, and the least powerful one is Judah. On the other hand, as far as we're concerned, the southern kingdom that's around Jerusalem, that has less influence and less power, is actually the more important one as far as the Bible's concerned, because this is the line that will endure and bring us to Jesus. This line will be destroyed by another factor we have to keep in mind. It's all over this book of Isaiah, and that is the problem of Assyria. Assyria is a country that no longer exists. It actually vanishes from the world stage kind of back at this point, and it's hard to draw its boundaries now. As far as I can tell, it'd sort of be Iraq and Turkey and a bunch of other areas would sort of, its boundaries would overlap. But of course, remember, back in those days, nations were much more fluid in terms of where they were on the map. But Assyria is an enormous issue in this book. What to know about it? Well, of course, it's not Jewish. And of course, it's very threatening. And they are notoriously cruel with those people that they conquer. Now, what to say about that? Assyria's fortunes go up and down. I mean, like any big empire, it has high points and low points, and a lot of what happens even in the career of Isaiah is going to cash in on, it's going to respond to high points and low points, is just how threatening Assyria is. But I mean, the thing you can never forget when you're reading this is Assyria is threatening. It makes people sweat. I mean, it's not the kind of thing where, I mean, you look and say, well, yeah, you know, I'm kind of worried about world events. I mean, there's something particularly pressing about Assyria, particularly on Judah and the ministry of Isaiah. Well, one of their strategies in war, I was just reading it this past week in a big encyclopedia with the learned articles on this thing, is how did Assyria do its warfare? Well, a combination of cruelty and psychological warfare. Was sort of characterized as the Assyrians. One of their favorite techniques, and these things get documented. You don't have to go to the Bible for these. There is various prisms, rocks, things written in stone. There are a lot of reliefs that have been uncovered that sort of map out the story of the Assyrians and how they do it. Things you can kind of read in stone about how they dealt things. But one of the things they like to do is they'd pick on a lesser, say if they're conquering an area, they'd pick on a lesser town, and they would just absolutely devastate it. And they would just cruelly destroy whatever that town was. And that, of course, has a couple of things. One, it eliminates that town, but it also sends terror throughout the rest of the populace, right? So, I mean, if Assyria was Michigan, for example, it's a close parallel, and they wanted to invade Ohio, they wouldn't attack Columbus, they'd attack London. And what would they do? Well, they'd kill all the old people, they'd torture people, they'd dismember people. Often they'd like to leave stacks of bones and skulls around and things like that. So you'd go into London and people in Dublin would start to get nervous, you know. You see what they did down there. You know, I mean, these people are crazy. They're psychos. And they did this quite intentionally and deliberately, and they documented that was the way they wanted to work. Assyria is an enormous issue. Another thing I wanted to talk about was that the ministry of Isaiah spans, you might say, three kings, but that's a little bit misleading, but three important markers in the career of Isaiah are the king Uzziah, the king Ahaz, and the king Hezekiah. Now, their dates are really complex, and we're going to have to look at all three kings here a little bit. But do you remember anything I said about these guys? Yeah, what did I say?
Pretty good.
Really bad. I don't know what I did. And very good, right? Pretty good, really bad, very good. Yeah, Uzziah, he's called by a different name in the books of Chronicles and Kings, and we'll just look at that. He is a really interesting study. And in some ways, he's only at the very beginning of Isaiah's ministry, it would appear. In some ways, the book launches itself at the death of Uzziah. But we want to look at three guys. Now, there are some other people to consider down this line. But let's look at this. All right. So, do you have it situated? I mean, situate the book at large. Isaiah, 8th century B.C., 66 chapters. The first 39 of those chapters are very much tied to the history of these three kings. They're very historically rooted. When you get to chapter 40, things begin to change in Isaiah, and it starts taking a bigger and more cosmic picture. Now, we have to come back to that, because there have been some people who have suggested that actually Isaiah, once you get to chapter 40, is not the prophet Isaiah speaking any longer, but someone else. They think disciples of Isaiah. Who is it? Who is talking there? I don't buy that theory. I'm holding on to the idea that the work of Isaiah is a unified work by the prophet Isaiah, touched up by some editors, of course, the way a lot of Old Testament books are. But that it's a consistent work. But it said 1 through 39 is one story. 40 through 66 is another. And there are even people who go further in terms of dividing it up. There are people who they call the second Isaiah Deutero-Isaiah, and then they'll call the, they think they're maybe the third Isaiah, Trito-Isaiah, 60 to 66. There's not a shred of manuscript evidence that would support that idea. I mean, any scroll of Isaiah is the prophet Isaiah, and it's been assumed in at least an early church history and an Old Testament history that this was one person speaking for the most part. We'll have to get back to that because that gets very important. All right, let's look at these kings. I think this will really help us understand something about the book of Isaiah. And so today's study, in a sense, we're going to once again hold off on digging into Isaiah to look at these kings, and we'll do it, of course, biblically. Let's look at Uzziah, first of all. I said a pretty good guy. He reigns for 52 years. At one point, though, we'll see that what you have established with this king is a co-regency. Do you know what that means? What's a co-regent? Yeah, he shared his kingship with someone else, in this case his son, and he does this because he becomes a leper. And so he can kind of roll, he has to stay in some level of seclusion, and his son kind of is going to carry on some of the great works. Now, his son, of course, Ahaz, very interesting. The dates here are very, very complicated, and, of course, the son Hezekiah. I think I was hearing that. How's that go? That if you get the chronology right, that Ahaz may have been the father of Hezekiah when he was about 14 or 15. But that's not totally inconsistent with Jewish history, or with history of kings at that time. But that's just one of those little tidbits. Uzziah reigns for 52 years. Think that's good or bad as a kingly record? That's a very good record. I mean, you get some guys in Israel reign like a month or two. kings don't often last long because succession struggles are ugly, and the assassinations occur and all kinds of things happen like that. Generally speaking, it's thought that he reigns from about 791 to about 740. And I say all these dates have to be considered, give them some leeway. Now, the story's told, if you want to find out about the kings and what they were like in the Bible, And remember, so this whole period of the kings and the prophets is very important. Where do you look?
Kings.
You look at the book of Kings. There are actually how many of those?
Two.
First and Second Kings. And where else might you look? First and Second Chronicles. Now, of course, you'll have to include Samuel in there if you want to get back into David and things like that. But for the most part, the record of the kings. This will take us from basically the time of the... just post-Solomon, you know, from the time of the divided kingdom to the collapse of both kingdoms at some point or other. What's the difference between Kings and Chronicles? They cover a lot of the same territory, but you know the difference in these books? If you read them, you read the same stories twice. Why would God do that to us? Well, that's true. No question. Some of the repetition in Scripture, I believe, is due to human stupidity. I mean, we get the point better if it's reiterated a few times. You know? What else? Well, First and Second Kings is probably the more elaborated and more objective view of what's going on in the Scriptures. First and Second Chronicles emphasizes what happens in the southern kingdom, in particular Judah, and also tends to moralize a little bit more. I mean, its fixation isn't on telling you about the politics as much as describing true worship and true succession. And in a sense, the Book of Chronicles often ignores the northern kingdom or gives it short shrift in order to concentrate on what's happening in Jerusalem and Judah and why things have gone amiss. So there's a different character to these books. But let's look at both of them here. First of all, we're going to look at Uzziah, the pretty good king. Let's read about him first in... let's go to 2 Kings 15. So these are parts of the Bible you probably don't open very often, right? So I have to give you some time to get there.
2 Kings what?
2 Kings 15. If you have to look in the index, don't be embarrassed. When I'm on with this stuff, I remember it fairly well. But I remember a woman in my congregation in Mobile telling me she thought that was an indication that there was something seriously wrong with me. If you can keep these guys straight, there's something seriously wrong with you. Okay, all right. But it's interesting. It gives you the background, which helps you understand these prophets. Everybody got to 2 Kings 15? And we're going to go back and forth between Kings and Chronicles here. Would somebody read us 1 through 5? 15, 1 through 5. Okay, very good. Now, does your translation say Uzziah?
Azariah.
What's up with that, I wonder? They're the same name, and I'm not sure what's up with that. Vowels are tricky in these languages, and why Azariah is also Uzziah, I can't give you a good answer, except we're talking about the same person, and it's completely non-controversial that his name would be rendered two different ways. So, all right, that's a pretty good description of him, isn't it? Does well. What's his only problem? Well, that's a problem. Does it say that God afflicted him with this? Yeah, the Lord struck the king so that he was a leper until the day of his death. Didn't take away the high places. What were the high places?
Pagan tribes?
Possibly. High places are weird. I mean, it's. I think what they were and who went to them and did what isn't entirely clear. Could be that it was a way of kind of keeping pagan worship alive along with your Jewish faith. Could be that it was just very irregular worship of the real God. But whatever it was not prescribed by God, and it was bad news. And it seems like not eliminating that's always kind of the seeds of problems. But as I understand, I've tried to read about high places. I mean, I've never gotten a real clear picture of them. I mean, it seems like were they dedicated, there are those people who sort of describe them as dedicated to pagan deities and just totally out of hand, than others who have suggested to me anyway that they're, you know, well, it wasn't that. It was sort of not the temple worship. It was sort of the irregular worship of people who didn't have very clear ideas. Well, let's go. That's the king's version of it. Let's go to Chronicles. Since Chronicles has kind of a fixation on... on the southern kingship. So you're going to turn ahead a couple books, right? You know, a little nice little section of scripture there. You'll get to 2 Chronicles, and we'll look at 2 Chronicles 26. And we'll fill in the story of Uzziah. 26. Now, just to get a picture, a fuller picture of Isaiah, remember, so Kings is objective. Chronicles is a little more fixated on the southern kings and what was happening with them. In particular, I think what's the big question we want to answer if we've just read Kings about this guy? Yeah, I mean, why did the Lord do that to him? That's a pretty serious and horrifying disease, isn't it? I mean, it clearly sidetracked an otherwise good king. Okay, so let's read a couple of different sections of this. Let's see, maybe we could do, would somebody read us verses 4 and 5? And we'll get a picture there of Uzziah again. Okay. So once again, now Chronicles gives us another picture of him. Things go well. He's a good, pretty good guy, apparently, like that. But the picture begins to change. Let's see. Let's read 15 and 16. 26, 15, and 16. We're still tracking this man's political career. Okay. You get this guy, he's like, you know, these kings. I mean, we don't have kings anymore, so it's hard to picture. But there are kings, and then there are kings. There are kings that work for self-aggrandizement, but there are kings that seem to be the great, you know, scholar kings who advance kingdoms. Here's this guy, he's even inventing devices to defend the city that hurl arrows and rocks, you know. Good guys beginning to build up, his fame is spreading as one of these kind of kings. That's, you know, really securing the land. But then his heart is lifted up, and he transgressed against the Lord by entering the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Well, what's the problem with that? Only the priests were allowed. Okay, now, this is an interesting thing here. Why? What's the problem? The Lord's blessed him. He's a good king. Shouldn't he be able to come in and offer sacrifices on an incense altar? Okay. Well, what principle is at work there? Is it just God being arbitrary, saying, "Look, this is the way I wanted it. Don't ask questions." Well, that's all. Never a really bad response, is it? You know? It's not right, but why isn't it right? Well, it's pride. Well, is motive the only? In other words, had he done it humbly, would have God said, "That's okay."
It's not the way God set it up.
Okay. Well, what principle do we see? We're all Americans here. Well, I think we are.
Follow the rules.
No, separation of church and state. No sense. No, the function of the priests, it has to remain outside of political control. I mean, if you start to blur that line, then the idea that the sort of government can manipulate the religion to serve the ends of politics, I think is always corrupting. I mean, at least, you know, according to the United States, it is. I mean, it's worked pretty well for us, you know, to say no. You know, that government has its agenda. You know, and whether even if it's great, even if it's in the hands of a wonderful person, it doesn't get to play this role because this role has to remain kind of sacred. A different person has to occupy it, and he has a priesthood that occupies that, and you don't cross that line. At least that's the way I interpret this. Let's read on here, 17 through 21. Would somebody get us? Okay, very good. Yeah, you see it. I should say the priests come into some 80 of them. I mean, it's not like, you know, like one fussy old priest came in and said, "You shouldn't be doing that." I mean, 80 guys, and described, you said, courageous, how did it say, courageous priests? So mine says, valiant men. I say, stop, you're not supposed to be doing this. I mean, they're really, I mean, that's quite a scene, isn't it? I mean, you know, 80 priests storming into the temple saying, stop that. You know, you can't do this. This is not correct for you to be doing. Well, that's a fascinating look at him. And it seems like for a person whose career seems so illustrious and under whom the nation really prospers and enjoys a lot of prosperity, that this particular sin seems to derail so much of it. And I think it's certainly worth pondering exactly what was at work there. Now, if you don't mind, look at Isaiah chapter 6 right now. Chapter 6, verse 1 says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple." As I said, in some ways, the ministry of Isaiah only overlaps the end of the reign of Uzziah. It's a prosperous time. It's a time of some dramatic things. Assyria is rising up, and not just Assyria, but some other things are happening. Remember that he is a co-regent with his son Jotham then, while because of his seclusion and leprosy. The son Ahaz then takes over the throne at this point. And as I said, it's very hard to get the years particularly right. Some people give his years 735 to 716. What did I say about him? Really bad guy. Let's do the same thing for him. First, we'll look at 2 Kings. As I said, much more kind of objective and shortened view of it without the moral text. Look at 16, 2 Kings chapter 16, 1 through 4. And would somebody read that to us? 2 Kings 16, 1 through 4. Okay, there would be a view of the high places that looks pretty bad, right? This is a bad guy. And one of the chief evidences of this is what in verse 3? Sacrifices his son. Well, what's that about? I don't think that's Baal worship. It could be a couple of different pagan worships. Moloch ate the little babies. I don't know if Moloch wanted the old stone furnace type things that the babies actually roll down the arms and into the furnace. It was a particularly hideous worship, and certain firstborns were selected there. There were other sacrifices going on. There's like an unsettling ability in Canaanite religion, I think, to find infants in foundation walls, isn't there? You know, where they maybe were killed and laid into the foundation of the building. There are various human sacrificial things going on there. As I said, I'm not sure exactly under what terms he would have done this to which deity, but maybe the scriptures tell us that, but I don't think so. I don't think they do. He offered him as a sacrifice. Well, why would you do that? Yeah. I mean, why do you do it? Did they think it was fun? Well, probably not. They probably thought it was an act of great piety. You know, probably looked at those who were unwilling to do that as impious persons. You know, are you willing to do that? You know, it's sick and perverse as it is a fairly dramatic act of worship, isn't it? Of course, we don't get to hear from his son in this process and what he thought of it or what age he might have been. Let's go to 2 Chronicles. We'll catch some more. Now we're in 2 Chronicles chapter 26. I'm sorry, 2 Chronicles chapter 28. All right, now I've mapped out a couple of different things to see what's happened in the career of Ahaz. 28 says, "Now Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord." For that, we've already heard it from in Kings. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, you know, the standard of bad things going on, made molded images of the Baals. Those were the Canaanite deities. I think they were mostly in the shape of bulls, weren't they? Bulls, like horns, you know, little bull-shaped deities. Burned incense in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and burned his children in the fire according to the abominations of the children. The people were kicked out, and he offered incense. We know all that. What's the significance of the valley of the son of Hinnom? Do you know? It's outside of Jerusalem, where he offered these flaming children sacrifices. The Valley of Hinnom, I believe this is the same, the Valley of Tophet, this is the same area that Jesus is talking about when he calls hell, Gehenna, is that valley. I mean, that's the Hinnom that is in the Aramaic version of the Hinnom, the Gehenna, not that place over in the other side of town, which I still want to know how it got its name. How did Gehenna get its name? The original settlers didn't like that place. That's my guess. I don't know. But Gehenna in the New Testament is one of the words Jesus exclusively, as far as I know, uses for hell, and it's the Valley of Hinnom. If you sort of parse it apart in Aramaic, and so this would be the place where Ahaz offered his children, that valley outside of... Really? So that would make sense, because apparently that part of Jerusalem then becomes the place where, you know, they discard stuff. I think they might have even discarded some of the unclean, the stuff left over from the temple and things like that, but it was the smoldering dump, you know, outside of Jerusalem, you know, a fearful and disgusting kind of place. What happens in his career? Now, this is very interesting. Let's look at we're still in 2 Chronicles 28, 5 and 6, or 28, and let's read 5 and 6. Somebody read that for us. Now, what's going on here? 120,000 people. That's a lot from a small kingdom. You know, I mean, that's a lot of people to be ruined, you know, in a sudden warfare. Well, what's happened here? Do you get the players now? Remember, Assyria is an enormous threat over everybody in that part of the world. But like all things like that, the smaller nations begin to team up and try to make a stand against the Assyrian threat. And so one of those nations, in this case, is Syria, and another one of these is the northern kingdom of Israel. And one of the things they're trying to do is to get Judah to come in with them to stand against the Assyrian threat. And when they don't do it, of course, that's a real problem, because then they start to attack and begin to put pressure on them for it. So what do you do at that point? Well, what we'll see happening is they make an appeal to the Assyrians to come and help them out of this situation. So that when you look at this in, let's see, 20 and 21. Well, just look over to verse 16 when you're in 28, you'll find that Ahaz makes a pitch to Assyria to get him out from under the problems of Syria and Israel. Now, Assyria's at this point kind of, they help him a little bit. I mean, the fact that he's appealed to Assyria helps him a bit, but not a lot. So that in 2021, you get, also Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came to him and distressed him and did not assist him. For Ahaz took part of the treasures from the house of the Lord, from the house of the king, and from the leaders, and he gave it to the king of Assyria, but he did not help him. In other words, his pitch to Assyria didn't really get Syria and Israel off his case. This is a huge factor in Ahaz's world, though, is that Syria and Israel are trying to get him to stand up with them against Assyria. This happens in other places in Jewish history. The Egyptians are a big player too. Everybody's trying to keep their distance from Assyria and trying to maybe build up coalitions that will help them to resist. Well, we don't need to go into great detail, but a lot of Isaiah's prophecies are going to be what to do with Assyria and what he's going to tell kings like Ahaz and Hezekiah what to do about Assyria, what to do about these coalitions that are forming. Should you join them? Should you not join them? I mean, you know, what's the role of Judah in all this? And we'll see that that's a big part of the book of Isaiah. I'm out of time, so we'll have to leave it. We'll have to pick up Hezekiah. Next week we start to look at the prophecies in Isaiah. But remember, if we're going to understand them as the original reader understood them, this huge Assyria factor is going to dominate everything that's said. Now, much of what's said then, we'll look ahead to the Messiah. But let's, yeah.
Just for clarity, the Syrians and the Aramaic are the same thing.
Oh, yeah, you had Aram when you read. you read, yeah. Aram and the the Syrians, not the Assyrians, are the same group. Let's take another let's finish with just another New Testament passage that quotes Isaiah. Revelations chapter 3, verse 7. Remember I said that the book of Isaiah clarifies who Jesus is. Like a prophet, it gives us a clear focus. Well, who is this Messiah who has showed up? How are we supposed to understand them? And we get Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. Would somebody like to read it? Once again, all through the New Testament, to clarify who Jesus is. You know, we saw it last week at the opening of Jesus' ministry. Here we see it in the last book of the Bible. Who is Jesus? Who is he speaking, in spirit to the churches in the book of Revelation? Well, he who has the key of David, who opens and no one shuts and shuts and no one opens. Very poetic, an image to ponder and think about. That's who Jesus is. If he opens it, it can't be shut. If he shuts it, it can't be opened. And that's a quotation from Isaiah chapter 22. Any final comments? We'll be getting past, if you're one of these people who just can't stand history, we'll be getting past it to some extent to look at Isaiah next week. But you need this background. Comments? Okay, next week.